Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and from around Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed so many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. And he went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. He appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again, so that they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, "He's out of his mind." This is God's word.
I will just enter our time with a short prayer from Psalm 19. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So an interesting dynamic is taking shape in the story that we heard read to us just now. We are in a series where we're going through the entire book of Mark, looking at encounters that people have with Jesus. And here we have this story of a wildly varied group of people who start to follow Jesus for various reasons. Really, it's a group of formerly divided people uniting around Jesus. And then we see those who are closest to Jesus, especially his family, begin to worry that he is losing his mind. And so previously united people are dividing because of Jesus. So divided people are uniting, united people are dividing. Last week we looked at a confrontation, a turning point moment in the book of Mark, where Jesus became very angry, grieved at the hardness of the hearts of his enemies, which he combated in a surprising way. He healed a man with a drooping hand. And here, the turning point of the story is really exhibited by the religious leaders of his day beginning to plot with actually their political opponents, the Herodians, to kill Jesus. It's a pretty incredible scene. And now, Mark, our biographer, is going to pivot into a long section. And so when you really like dig into these scriptures, you'll see little signs that show you that certain areas are connected. And this one's connected because it starts with his family thinking he's crazy. And at the end, it concludes with him saying, "My true family are my disciples." And that comes later. This is actually chapters later. And the whole section here is about how people divide up around Jesus, how their hearts respond to Jesus. And we're just looking at a piece of it today. And in this piece, we're going to look at this crowd that gathers around Jesus, the disciples of Jesus, the family of Jesus, and ask, what do these have to do with us? The crowd, the disciples, and the family. So my sermon's called Encountering Jesus in Divisive Times. So as we think about the crowd, what makes the times back then divisive? If you've been around our church or this series for a while, you've been hearing me say that this time was no less problematic than our own. And imagine if these ancient people had had these little, media boxes in their pocket that they could pull out and see the news that enraged them the most at any moment. Imagine how much worse it could have been if they'd had that kind of access to all the annoying things that everyone was thinking all the time. I think our technology actually magnifies the division in our society, and their lack of it probably mutes their divisions to some point. If you think about it, if their friend across the country had a wildly divergent thought than theirs and wanted to communicate it with them, it might take 2 months for them to find out about it. Imagine how much that probably muted their divisions. But still, this is a turbulent time. It was turbulent internationally, between nations, obviously. Rome at the time is occupying the known world. There's something called the Pax Romana that's in place, which means that there was a certain peace that existed under the rule of the Roman Empire, but it was an external peace because not everyone under that peace appreciated that peace. There were people who their divisions were internal. So Israeli people or Jewish people from whom this story comes felt like the Roman world had kind of subjugated them and was forcing its thinking onto them. It wasn't something that they wanted to do necessarily, but even Jewish people were divided up into sections as to how they felt about this. The Roman world, if you read the history of its leaders, isn't completely united either. There's all sorts of divisions and power struggles that are going on within the Roman world. And this all sort of sounds familiar. In the Jewish world, and then you can actually get into the religious Jewish world. And are they all united? And they're not. There are Pharisees, who we've talked about several times, prominent in the last couple of stories that we've studied here. And here, the Pharisees, if you're kind of a religious-leaning person or a patriotic-leaning person, you might really relate to them because they want to conserve their nation's identity. At the core, they want to conserve their like religious moorings. They want to be good people who do the right thing. And they were also kind of underdogs in their society. They wanted to be liberated from oppression. So they're good moral people who are underdogs and want to be liberated from oppression. There are probably a number of ways you could relate to that. Then you have the Sadducees, and these are kind of the educated elites, you could say, who are also religious. So they are into their religion as well. They care about their nation as well, but with some moderation. And they think, you know, if we kind of collaborate more with the Romans, if we're a little bit more on the same page as the Romans, that'll probably work out better for everybody who's involved. They wanted to defend their religious views to skeptics by shaving off some of the rough edges and the moral strictness, and they wanted to be more, aligned with the things that other people saw as inconsistencies. So if something was seemed too religious, they wanted to kind of mute it down a little bit and get along with more people, have a faith that was reasonable in other people's minds. And both of those movements were pretty moderate compared to others who might fully participate with Rome, actually opposing or oppressing their own people to do so, such as somebody who we just read about a couple weeks ago, Levi, who was actually completely in league with the Romans. He was a tax or toll collector who was considered an utter traitor to his people, and he's oppressing his own people and joining in with Rome. And then there's the Herodians, who were the people who were in line with the Herods, the Jewish Herods, who were ruling alongside the Roman leaders. So those people had just completely gone into an alliance with Rome. And then on the other side, there were the zealots or the revolutionaries who made the Pharisees look pretty chill because they were so concerned with honoring God that they wanted to win at all costs by overthrowing the oppressive regime and gaining total independence from Rome. And there were many movements in these days where there were, you know, attempts at takeovers. And the Jewish people generally, maybe they weren't as wild as the zealots, but they kind of hoped they'd win. In a way. So all these movements and more are swirling around, and that's just within the Jewish world and especially within the religious Jewish world. And then, just as is true today, nobody quite fit a category, right? Just like, you know, we know people and we know our categories today. But every time when you really get to know a person, you realize, well, they don't entirely fit in that box. They have a thought or two that make them kind of on the edge of that category, or they could kind of shapeshift a little bit depending and fit into different categories because there are innumerable self-interests that lead people to do their own thing and further divide from one another. So that's the ancient world, and aren't you glad it's not that way anymore? We're not like those people. Okay, we're a little bit like those people, but there are people who are on the wrong side of it, unlike us good people in this room. See, we are doing it right. Unless history's repeating itself, in which case, we're all just doing the same things that have always been done over and over again, and we tend to see things from our own viewpoint and can't understand how other people see them and how it all makes sense to each person in their own mind. So, the crowds, okay? The crowds are full of all these people who are in wildly different positions, but they're crowding around Jesus. How? For what? The crowds, it says, have become great crowds. And this means that the news about Jesus has spread, and people are traveling between towns and telling their friends and their family that, what? People are getting healed and delivered from evil spirits. So people are hearing about these stories of Jesus. This is stuff we've learned about in the past month or so. That Jesus is doing some wild and incredible stuff, stuff that seems near impossible to us. So if you think about the people who you think, wow, they just, something is like dark and terrible going on within them, and it's really like, it's almost like it's taken them over and they're controlled by it. Or you think about the people in your life, the cancer patients, the people who need healing. If you started hearing that all of these people were becoming delivered from what they were dealing with and were becoming whole people, And that was centering around, you know, I don't know, Joey right here. And Joey, they're just coming to Joey, and Joey's like talking to them, reaching out to them, and they're all being transformed. You might want to get to know Joey. You might get kind of curious about what is going on with Joey. That's good news to you. You would hear that and go, this is good news. I want to be healed or fixed. I want people in my life to be healed or fixed. Let's go see Joey. It's important to note here that the crowd, the following of the crowd is specific. Jesus has been calling his disciples to follow him. And there's a word that infers that this is a discipleship or an apprenticeship or a mentorship. This is a different kind of following. This is the following of, and I just realized my slides were all off. Here we go. I fixed it. It's the following I used to do. So some of you know I'm a big baseball fan. So I was an autograph kid. And back in the day when I was an autograph kid, we had spring training in Tucson, and the facilities weren't nearly as fancy as they are today. And so at High Corbett Field, the players, the professional baseball players, back when baseball was booming, had to exit the locker room and swim through all of us kids with our baseball cards for like 100 yards to get to their bus, okay? And so this, you know, and I was big into this, and so I've got all my cards, and I'm like, Mr. Canseco, Mr. McGuire, you know, come here. And I remember one day when Ken Griffey Jr., the kid from Seattle, was in town, and it was packed because he was massively popular. And so there's this huge crowd, and he came out of the locker room and sees all of us, all just like baseball cards, like, you know, straight out in front of our heads. And he decided he wasn't going to do it. And so he just did this. He literally swam. And I was shoved to the ground by King Griffey Jr. And I decided I was not a fan of his. I was like, I don't like that guy. Now, I can't imagine being him. That sounds, frankly, miserable. That's the kind of crowd situation we're talking about with Jesus, where they are pressing in, surging in toward the healer who has become a local celebrity, and it's this chaotic scene, this great crowd that's pressing in on him, and the language here of what he's afraid is going to happen to him, like crushed, or it's almost, the word is even something like clawed, like he's going to get injured by this crowd. That's how he feels. And unclean spirits, it says. I mean, just imagine, okay, take my Ken Griffey Jr. scene and add this layer, that one of us kids with our baseball card drops on the ground and says something, you know, something to the effect of like, "You are the one sent from God." Right? That would be really weird. And that's like, that was happening. And then Jesus is not only hearing that, but he's telling them all to stop talking. He's like, "Stop saying this, be quiet, go away." That's what he was saying to the people who were yelling out stuff about who he was and falling down in front of him and saying, "You are the Son of God." And he was commanding them, it says, to stop. This is quite the scene. It really is. Okay, so what do we think of the crowds? I mean, if we're pro-Jesus, it's like, well, he's popular, right? He's popular. But all throughout the Gospels, the crowds are kind of cast as this fickle group. The crowds, of course, here they are, they're following after him, they want to be healed. Later on, Jesus is going to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, which I've described this here so many times. It's a strange scene. Probably the week before, Pontius Pilate rode into Jerusalem in the front gate on a stallion, because a triumphal entry is what you would do if you're a political leader, and everyone would, you know, like, hey, you know, they would worship, they would wave things, they would say, "Save us," which is the word Hosanna, which they would say to their liberators. Jesus rides into the back gate of Jerusalem on a baby donkey. It's a very strange scene. But they're still crying out to him, and they're saying, "Save us," and they're waving their palm branches. And very soon after, this seems to be intentional, the crowds, the same crowds, same people, maybe, we don't know, but the crowds are now gathering and yelling, "Crucify him," very soon after. The crowds are very fickle. You can't depend on them. They'll say, "Save us," and they'll come to you for healing, but then they'll say, "Crucify him." They can turn on you. They're in when you're healing. They're out when you're bleeding. If you engage in any kind of important or public work, you might taste just a little bit of this reality. You do something really, really good, people love it. When you mess up, watch out. They'll be done with you, right? The crowds. The crowds are in it for what Jesus can give to them, the healing, the thrill of being in a great person's presence. And what about us? What draws me, what draws you to Jesus? One of the early stories in this series of encountering Jesus I told was getting pneumonia and going into the hospital, and I was like, "God, right? I'll give you my life." It was my first time in the hospital. I didn't know. I was like scared. I was hooked up to an IV. I didn't know what was going on. I was like, "I'll give you my whole life." And then it's, you know, it's pneumonia. It's not good. But I didn't realize, you know, how, like, I should have saved that for later. Like, worse things were coming, right? But I didn't know. And so I'm like, "Jesus, I'll do anything. Get me out of pneumonia," right? That's natural. That's what the crowds do. And Jesus, he knows they might crush him, but he doesn't turn them away. But you'll see, they're going to turn on him. They're very back and forth. So there's the crowds, right? And then there's the disciples. Now, we tend to think about the 12 disciples. Here's a good, I think there's 12, I didn't count actually, in this picture. But we tend to think about the 12 disciples, and he's going to name those, Mark's going to name those right now. But the disciples are a bigger group, actually. There's a point where Jesus, elsewhere in the scriptures, sends out about 70. There's this group of people that are consistently following Jesus. And then he chooses 12 of them to be what are called apostles. So why 12, right? Why 12? This is not a coincidence. This is not his favorite number. There's a reason for this. And to get the reason, and we have to do a difficult thing, we have to kind of try to get back into Jesus' audience's shoes here for a second and remember some Old Testament stories. So here goes. I know we will not give this the time it deserves. But in the Old Testament scriptures, God chooses a representative patriarch. And there's this point where he chooses this man, Abram. We call him Abraham, and it kind of seems arbitrary. There's no good reason to think he's any better than anybody else around him. He doesn't have a particular like family pedigree or anything like that that makes a lot of sense. It feels like God just kind of arbitrarily says, you, and picks him out and makes this incredible promise to him that he's going to have children and he's going to have a great family. He shows him the stars of the sky and says, you'll have this many kids, which feels impossible, and it was. And then Abram and his wife are too old to have a child, but they do have one. And then God takes him up on a mountaintop and says, you know, give me your son and sacrifice him to me. And Abram is very confused, and this sounds all very dark and strange. And then God provides a substitute sacrifice so that his son is still his. And Abram's trying to unpack what all of this means. But God says, like, okay, now I've made a sacrifice and I've given you your son. He's going to become a great nation, and he's going to be a blessing to all nations. Okay. So Abram's son has a son and has, you know, numerous kids. And so Abram's grandson, Jacob, kind of comes along, and he's a bit of a deviant young man, and he's deceptive, and he's tricking his brother, and he just can't get along. And there's a lot of, he's just like kind of like the problem teenager or whatever. And he, at some point in his life, when he's just made quite the mess and his brother actually wants to kill him, he gets into a wrestling match with God and prevails, or he endures it. But God leaves him wounded and gives him a new name, and the new name is Israel, which means those who wrestle with God. And then his children are divided up into tribes, and there's 12 tribes of those who wrestle with God, or Egypt, or Israel, sorry. And then they end up finding deliverance in Egypt, but there they are also eventually enslaved. And then God, after their 400 years there, delivers them with some powerful acts, some incredible things, and takes them to a mountain, and from the top of the mountain declares to them who he is and presents them with his law, which is what the kids all talked about today, and promises them a land and an inheritance, and to that they could go to the land, but they are needing to be faithful in the land. And they go to the land, and they fail to be faithful. They don't keep the law, as the kids talked about. So God had said, you'll be given over to your enemies, but eventually I'll gather you together and I'll save you. And it's all a very kind of up and down roller coaster of a story. So Abram, mountaintop, Isaac, big promises, okay? The Israel, those who wrestle with God, they go to Egypt, they're taken to a mountaintop, they're given the law of God, they're sent to their new land, they fail, and now there's a man who's delivering people from sickness and death and demonic power, and he goes up on a mountaintop, and he brings 12 men up with him and says, I'm going to send you out into all the nations to cast out demons. If you're an ancient person, this is what you're thinking. An ancient Jewish person, he is restoring Israel. That's what you're thinking. You're seeing these 12 leaders are like the 12 tribes. He's bringing healing. He's doing what the Old Testament had said was always going to happen. He's continuing the promise to Abraham. That's what you're seeing. I know that's a lot. Okay, so there you go. That's what it would mean to them. He's restoring Israel, but not the Israel that you would expect, because it starts in Israel, and then they're going to go out to all the nations. And it's not tied to a geopolitical entity, Israel. It's actually starting with these apostles who are, like I said, they're going to go out to non-Israelite people, but they're also a surprising group. Surprising to the observers of this whole thing, and surprising to each other. Surprising to the observers because they're very ordinary people. They're not powerful. They're not influential by and large. Some of them, like Matthew, are downright problematic. Like, they're not who you'd put on the team if you were trying to do something incredible and building an alliance. These disciples later are referred to as unskilled and ordinary men in the book of Acts. People say, who are they? How do they think they have any authority? They're unskilled, ordinary men. And this was common knowledge. They lived in a smaller community. It was common knowledge. Also, the disciples didn't expect each other. We just got this long list of who the disciples were, and we knew about four or five in the book of Mark leading up to this, Andrew and Peter, James and John. They're kind of the least surprising. They're fishermen, so they're kind of blue collar, but they're probably good Jewish boys who practice their Judaism. We hear about Philip and Bartholomew, and you hear about them, and you go, yeah, I don't really know too much about where they end up, but you know, that's not too surprising. But then there's Matthew, and this is either, it's either Levi has kind of two names, Levi, Matthew, or even if it was a different person, this is a tax collector. This is one of the people who's traded his allegiance over to Rome and overtaxes his people. We talked about him. You could go back to the Vegas sermon we did here a few weeks ago, where he is like the Vegas kingpin, where he kind of like, he's got his entourage. So he would have had Roman soldiers who enforced things against his own people. He would have been very wealthy, very successful, and his people would have really disliked him. And this name in the list is a shock. There are tax collectors and traders that take advantage of their fellow citizens, and he gets thrown in here with these good Jewish boys, the little blue-collar guys, and I guarantee you they did not like each other at all. Then we have Thomas. Later we're going to hear that Thomas expresses some doubts, but we all are pretty understanding of that sort of stuff. There's James and Thaddeus, which are kind of remarkable for how little we hear about their lives in a way. But then we have another surprising name, and the fact that they put this like modifier on it, Simon the Zealot, is important because this probably means that he was a Jewish revolutionary. So this is like if you were going to have a very polar opposite person to Matthew, it's Simon the Zealot. This is a guy who is probably a trained fighter who's trying to overthrow the government. And Matthew is somebody who has given his allegiance over to the government and overtaxes his people. And then, finally, is Judas Iscariot. And his last name either infers to the fact that he was from a certain town or that he was also from a violent sect himself, okay? So this is a surprising entourage for Jesus. Surprising to the people who would have looked at it from the outside and surprising to the people who would have looked at it from the inside. This is a team. I don't know if you've ever read Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, where Abraham Lincoln, you know, has his opponents in the presidential race and then he brings them into his cabinet. And it generally is pretty genius, even though it gets a little dicey at times, but overall it worked. It's kind of like that, where you're in the cabinet with the people you were trying to destroy, like last week. That's kind of what it feels like to be in this group of disciples. And so Mark here is signaling something to us. This is a very diverse group. One of them, he tells us, is going to betray Jesus. He tells us from the outset. He's kind of saying, this is a surprising bunch. And it's going to be a bit of a wild card. Now, consider this. Jesus when they follow Jesus, they are going to take him on as their kind of mentor. They're going to apprentice under him. They're going to walk with him everywhere they go. This, you know, they didn't have Zoom meetings. They were with each other for hours and hours and hours. Can you imagine being with people that just drove you insane politically, like 6 to 8 hours a day? No. Then you don't know what it's like to be a disciple. Think about that. Think about that. We've got all this wild diversity, and they're together for tons of time, and there is one thing that's keeping them together, and that is Jesus. So the new Israel, so they're, when they heard, when they saw these 12 people were brought together, these 12 apostles, they're thinking new Israel. The new Israel is not unified, not in the way that you would expect, not in the way that a state would unify or even a club would unify. Jesus is assembling disciples who enter in divided. He's assembling people who were divided. Now you could say, well, some of these guys were like brothers too, so they had that kind of stuff going on. And some of that, by the way, didn't work out so well either. These family allegiances, James and John, who Jesus called this, and this is probably a joke by Jesus, we think, the sons of thunder. It's kind of a joke. It feels a little bit like, okay, sons of thunder, like calm down, buddies. Like you're a little intense. It's kind of a caricature. But they, at one point, they bring their mom involved. I mean, think about your political opponent and Jesus decides to follow him, and then their mom starts like pitching in, right? Their mom gets involved and you're like, why is your mom here? So James and John's mom wants them to be the greatest and sit at Jesus's right hand. And then everybody's like, oh my gosh, like they got angry. They're so frustrated. So even the brothers who are on the same page are bothering everybody because they're trying to win. And Jesus brings these non-like-minded people into community with each other and says, follow me and we're going to be the new Israel together. Really? He does not gather like-minded people into their ideal community. He gathers divided people, sends them out to further divided people, the nations, and he doesn't even suggest that they should gather together under their preferences. He calls them to unify under himself only. So that's a challenge. There's a bit more to say. It's interesting. He says he called who he desired that they would be with him. This adds this element of kind of friendship. Jesus will go on to say, I have called you friends. So he's not just asking them to get along like a business relationship. He wants them to have a deep friendship with him and therefore with one another. I had a friend in high school named Pike. He's still around town. And Pike had that, he had this magnetism to him where all these people wanted to be his friend. And you realize that once we got out of high school and we all weren't around Pike, the rest of us weren't friends. It was Pike that brought us all together. Jesus is like that. He's the friend that gathers his group of people together. He is the bonding friend. He also calls them apostles and gives them his authority. And an apostle, that word means sent ones or ones who are sent. And so he's sending them with a unified mission. And for what? To fight, to win, to take over? Well, the one thing it says here is to cast out demons. And I know that in our culture, that's like a weird concept. But if you think about it, what power do they have? They have a power to set other people free. That's not a power that's about them. It's a power about setting other people free. Notice the profound difference between the crowd and the disciples. The crowd is pressing in for what they can get from Jesus. A disciple is called to deliver deliverance on behalf of Jesus to others. The promise to Abraham was that God was going to bless people who assembled through him, and that's exactly what Jesus is doing through his disciples. He's assembling a new Israel, and they're going to be a blessing to the nations, unified by him and characterized by what he has sent them to do. Okay, so the crowds and the disciples, very different. And then there's the family. Family has the potential to be the closest affiliation in the world, right? I mean, how many of us that have a family, you know, don't want it to be good? And how many of us that have a broken family wish that it was better, right? And Jesus's family here is not on board. In fact, they are concerned that he's out of his mind, which is a way of saying, like, he's out here delivering people who are possessed by evil. They're starting to worry he's possessed. They're starting to worry that something is wrong with him. Family is not always what it should be, right? And Jesus experienced that in his human life. But it's deeper than that. I mentioned this large section, and it starts here in chapter 3, and it ends in chapter 6. And the whole thing is about people's acceptance or rejection of Jesus. And it includes a well-known portion called the parable of the sower that has these three soil types that talk about three different ways that humans receive Jesus. There's a hardened soil where the word about Jesus just can't even enter in. It's blocked by the hardness of the soil. There's an infested soil that has weeds in it, which are the worries and troubles of life. And so people hear about Jesus, they're intrigued, but they just have way too much going on. And they're just way too worried, and they think, I can't really do this. I can't really follow Jesus. And then there's the good soil, where the message of Jesus, it doesn't just like hit those people, it actually sinks deep down and it begins to change them. And a new life emerges within them. And here in this section, we have the three groups, the crowd, the disciples, and the family, and they follow the same pattern. Except shockingly, the family is the hard soil, right? And chapter 6 ends with Jesus returning home on the Sabbath day, which is a day when he would, when this whole thing had started on a Sabbath day where he'd entered into a synagogue and he taught. And it feels like these are inclusios or kind of bookends on these stories. But it says this, he came to his hometown and his disciples followed him. So here's Jesus, the disciples are with him. And on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? What is this wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown, among his relatives, and his own household. See, he takes it closer and closer to home. And he could do no mighty work there except he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled at their unbelief. Those who you expect to be the closest, who'd seen Jesus' life firsthand, who he would have hoped to have close to him, being a person, of course you would, they're offended by him the most. Those who he spent the most time with, who he was the closest to, were offended by him the most. And this is often true in religious circles, by the way. Often, those who are most offended by Jesus are those who you would expect to be really close. Now, the family also points to some good news because, just as the flash forward, some of them actually do end up being disciples. His mother, his brother James, his brother Jude. And also we learn in the midst of this whole section, 3 through 6, we expect it's all these synagogue and religious leaders are against Jesus, but one of them, Jairus, is part of the crowd. He brings his sick daughter to Jesus. His daughter is healed. And you see that he's moving the other direction. He's moving toward Jesus, not away. So we see that people in the crowds can be changed. We see that the family can be changed. But we also see that the crowds can turn on Jesus and family can reject Jesus. So we have the family, the hometown relatives are offended by Jesus. Disciples are called to follow Jesus and sent by Jesus. So how do we learn from all this in divisive times? What can we take away? I was thinking about our little church here and just a few things. The crowds have mixed motives, and this is just always the case. Jesus did not turn them away. Though he was human and he had to distance himself and rest, he didn't turn them away. Who of us always has come to Jesus with the right heart? As I mentioned before, like one of my big moments of telling Jesus I would give him my life is just because I didn't want to be in a hospital, right? That wasn't worship. So much. It was, I wanted something, but I believed he could offer it. And my early commitments were very much about me. And this is a constant fight. I've shared this before. We used to have a confession time before church, and I miss it. Why do I miss it? Because before I would preach a sermon, I always had to think, why am I doing this? And do you know why I'm often doing this? Because I want you to respect me. I want you to think I've done a good job. I want you to think I've done my homework, right? I want this church to work because somehow it's attached to me and that seems to matter, right? That's so selfish, but honest. Like that's just what it is to be human. Our motives are always so mixed up. And I'm so thankful to God that he doesn't look and see all those mixed motives and turn away from us, right? He's so patient. So forgiving that even when we act like we're worshiping, sometimes we aren't. And we need to remember that in divisive times. Because so often we are so hard on people who come to Jesus for the wrong things or do it in the wrong way. And we have to ask this, is Jesus turning them away or is that just me? Is Jesus turning them away or is that just me? If Jesus can forgive my wrong motives and continually work on changing my heart, couldn't he do that for others? And why wouldn't he? Am I better? We need to ask, what if he's calling someone we don't want to be a disciple? Would we follow Jesus with that person if that's what Jesus is asking us to do? Even if that whole process takes a long time? I think we need to imagine being a part of the grouping of disciples. I, again, think about the 70 and all the variety of people that would have been in there. But think about it. I think sometimes we have to imagine what that would be like. For Jesus to have called a zealot and a tax collector to follow him, the sons of thunder who wanted to do all these big things, and these obscure disciples who we never really hear about. He called together these ununified people and unified himself or them around himself. We need to think about what it means to walk in a faith that only has one faith, one Lord, one baptism, and it's all about Jesus. And that means all the other stuff that we want people to do and love and agree on is less important. We need to imagine that. We need to remember that. We need to place our faith in Jesus and his capacity to change people and not just our own. I think we've made a grave mistake in our day and followed our culture in choosing religious communities based on our preferences. And this is actually dividing over all the wrong things. There's a book we read years back when we were trying to unpack some of like the racial divisions in our world called Divided by Faith. And one of the conclusions that that book came to, which was surprising to many of us, I think, was that our consumerism is one of the biggest reasons actually on paper that we divide up racially when we worship. And I'm not saying that's all there is to it, but at the end of the day, people who said they were committed to racial reconciliation would divide because they just didn't like being around each other. They didn't like the differences. They didn't like the stupid little stuff like music styles. And it just didn't feel like home to them. So they split up. If we could get over that petty stuff, maybe we could actually work at what matters. But that's going to take work. It means laying down stuff that is dear to us. But what if Jesus is asking us to do that? Because he wants us to be unified for his sake. We should ask questions like this. Jesus, who have you called me to follow you beside? And then we should submit to that and say, then I'll do it. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll lay down preferences of my own to walk beside who you want me to walk beside. And we should also expect that if we really do that, some people will be offended by that. Some people who we really, really like, even maybe family, right? And that offense, notice, Jesus in our text didn't offend these people because he had no tact. He didn't offend these people because he was a terrible listener, right? The offense was that they just didn't accept that he was who he said he was. The offense was about the type of like gathering he was bringing together. He was delivering people from evil and healing people, and they were worried about that. It wasn't because he was being a jerk and a terrible listener. So don't think that just because you're dividing from people, you're following Jesus. That's not necessarily true, right? And finally, we need to remember that God plays the long game. And this sermon's been a long game, and you guys have been doing a really great job. Some people with wrong motives receive healing and begin to open their hearts to more, and time will reveal motives. By time, I mean God's working things out, and we just have to wait and see. Some people may look like disciples and end up being betrayers like Judas, and it's up to Jesus to work that out, not us. Some people like his family may be skeptical and offended, but years later may come around and be the most devoted disciples. So just because somebody's in your circles is expressing they don't love Jesus or want to follow Jesus, don't give up on them. Like, you don't know. Amen. You don't know what's going to happen, right? And at the end of the day, the question is my heart receptive? And how am I supposed to follow Jesus? And then whoever he brings along, okay. I want to share a story of a friend of mine. We've been having people get up and tell stories, and there's a short video I've got here of my friend Caleb. He has a really unique story. I understand if you're on the stream, this audio isn't going to work, unfortunately. So I'll just tell you slightly about it. But Caleb's a pastor in Phoenix at a church where he was once invited just after he'd gotten out of being a neo-Nazi skinhead. And he had done that because he'd seen hypocrisy in the church. And so then that church took him in, and now he's the pastor of it. And then all of a sudden, his church was entirely severed and divided because a Christian nationalist group set up shop within eyesight of his church and drew a bunch of people away. And he lost a massive amount of some of his closest friends and family. And he doubled down and has committed himself not only to standing up for his beliefs, but to loving specifically Christian nationalists and to being patient and guiding them back into an understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. It's going to be hard work. Publicly, he has been just, you know, he's been shot at like, I mean, not shot at like, I mean, publicly, he's getting defamed all over the place for his attempts to do this. But he's a friend of mine, and I'm proud to be his friend, and he's doing some really good work. So I wanted you to hear just a little bit of his story here before I wrap us up. Caleb has exhibited just a lot of commitment to, like I said, really to love people who have chosen to hate him, actually. He doesn't go into all that, but knowing him, I know that's exactly what it's been. And it's been really, well, to me, it's felt quite like the flavor of what we see in the Bible. I'm encouraged by Caleb's story. It's a reminder that people, you know, often enter into the community when they aren't disciples. He doesn't go into that exactly, but when he became a drummer for the church, he wasn't a Christian at all. And this family just took him in and started getting to know him. And he didn't have a moment where he's like, I decided to follow Jesus. It was more like a discovery where he went, is this being a Christian? Because I think I'm doing it. I also have to say I'm encouraged by his commitment to of the hard work that he does to actually, you know, live in that integrity that he talks about. Because he's reaching and working to reconcile with people who are currently just at odds, entirely at odds. But it's his work's fueled by a vision of what it means to really, truly lay down whatever it's going to cost and follow Jesus. To be a part of the restored Israel and to gather people at the table. And I loved what he said about that. You know, enemies gathered around the table and becoming friends, which to us is a good lead-in to taking the Lord's Supper. Because Jesus, you know, that wild group of apostles that he gathers together, it says on the night he was betrayed later. So here's this early hint that we read in our scripture, Judas is going to betray him. And here we are at the night where Judas does his evil act, right? Where he's been colluding with the Pharisees, who've been colluding with the Herodians, and they all have a plan, and they're going to take down Jesus. And we know they do. You know, that's exactly what they do. And on that night, when Jesus, who had foretold that this was going to happen, the night he was betrayed, he takes bread from the table and he breaks it to this surprising group of disciples who are really only united around him. And he said, this is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of this, remember me. And that doesn't just mean like have an interesting memory. It means pattern yourself after me. He takes the wine from the table. Wine has a lot of symbolism in the scriptures, everything from judgment to the festive drink. And he said, this is my blood of a new promise, the forgiveness of many in me. Every time that you drink it, remember me. And he goes on to say, the next time I drink this wine with you, it'll be in my kingdom. It'll be new wine in my kingdom. And it's this hopeful moment where he's saying, take this message that there's a new kingdom coming. It's going to be different than all the ones that you've seen here on this earth. I'm going to be the center of it. And take this out like wine poured out, like a taste of a coming party, a taste of a coming kingdom. Take Jesus to these people. He's saying, center yourself on me and then spread the good news. Watch what I do in the lives of people. Invite them to this table. So as we respond to that and we ask the question of, am I willing to receive what Jesus has done for me? Am I willing to follow Jesus with all the people that I don't even always relate to that he has asked to follow him? That's our call to the table. Today, what we do is we line up and we come by this table and I'm going to serve this to you. Today, I want you to pay extra attention to the people walking forward and think about, would I be united to this person if it weren't for Jesus? And I guarantee that the answer won't always be yes. And I want you to marvel at what God is doing in bringing together a community that didn't exist outside of him. And then when you walk away from this table, I want you to consider the question, so who can I invite toward Jesus, even if it's somebody who I would not unite with myself? Okay? So look at the people who are taking from the table, marvel at what Jesus is doing, and ask what would it mean to invite other people near to him, to something that's more powerful than any political cause, to something that's far more transformative. So yeah, we're entering into some like divisive political times. We've hardly talked about it because honestly, I don't think talking about it is gonna help us out. We need to be unified around something greater. I'm gonna pray here briefly. There's gonna be 2 minutes of silence. This is a time just to contemplate these things, to search your heart. To consider whether or not you can receive what Jesus is offering to you, to confess anything you need to confess before Jesus, or just to be still and silent before him. After that, we will take the Lord's Supper together, which I've just explained. We're also going to give. We're not going to like pass something around for giving. There's a box in the back and an iPad back there. And the posture of giving for us is that God is a generous God. He's given us every single thing that we have, and our giving is giving back to God out of the abundance of what he's given to us and saying to God, we know that you don't obligate us to do this, but we want to love and offer and sacrifice and honestly invest in the work of this good news and this invitation. So you can give at that giving station in the back. There's links to text to give that'll be up here. You can always give on our website too. And finally, we're going to sing together, which is kind of this way of taking these ideas and just letting them sink into our souls by rehearsing them in memorable ways. So I'll pray, and we'll enter into 2 minutes of silence. Father, I want to thank you for this body of people you brought together today. Right when we opened up the service, God, I was saying how much I love this church, and I really do. But I never would have met most of these people if it weren't for you calling us to walk together. And I would have assembled a whole different group of friends that would have looked like me and acted like me and talked like me. And I'm really grateful that you've invited me into something more rich, into the lives of people who don't always agree with me, who sometimes call me to change. And sometimes just offer words of wisdom that I never would have thought of myself, and who sometimes you call me to speak to as well. And God, I know you're doing that in all of our lives. You're doing something better than what we would design ourselves. So thank you for being an involved God who knows what we really need and for your invitation. So lead us now as we pray.